Hello, and thank you all for joining us on the Kansas Canopy podcast. My name is Ariel Whiteley Knoll, and I am the communications coordinator for the Kansas Forest Service. This is season 4, episode 2, and today we are going to be talking about riparian forests. Our guest today, Andy Klein, is the water quality forester for the Kansas Forest Service. Andy, thank you so much for being on with us today.
Oh, thanks, Ariel. I'm super excited to be here.
So first, can you just talk a little bit about what it is that you do for the Kansas Forest Service?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. And what this, you said this is a 2-hour podcast, right?
Absolutely. Just clear your schedules, everybody. This is going to be a good one.
Oh, yeah, I'm excited. I could talk forever on this. My title is Water Quality Forester. And I always think that's kind of weird. Like, what is a water quality forester? What exactly does that mean? In some ways, it's simple. I do forestry projects to help improve water quality. But then, of course, it gets a little more complex than that. And I always like to go back to Dr. Charlie Barden, the K-State Extension Forester's line on using trees and shrubs and other native plants to solve environmental problems. So specifically, I'm using trees and shrubs to solve primarily water quality and a little bit of water quantity issues.
That's awesome. So a big part of your work, we like to use the word riparian forest, but that's not super clear to everybody. So what exactly is a riparian forest?
Yeah, well, riparian forest is just simply forests, woodlands, trees that are in that riparian zone. And a riparian zone is simply just something next to water. And it doesn't matter if it's a big river, like the Kansas River, or a small wetland that only holds water during wet times, or more of a pond or a wetland type that's got ducks and geese flying in the fall. But just a riparian area is just anything next to water. And in Kansas, it's almost a little redundant to say riparian forest because our true forests, you know, our dense areas of trees, do tend to be in riparian areas because that's where the water is and the fire is not, you know, over the evolution of this prairie landscape we have. So riparian is kind of redundant. Riparian forest is kind of redundant for Kansas because a lot of our trees and woodlands are just in those kind of lower, wetter areas with deeper soils compared to out in the uplands of the prairie. Shallower soils and kind of more extreme environments where the grasses and native forbs and stuff can tolerate it better than trees. So, just kind of by nature, a lot of our forests in Kansas are riparian. So just forests next to water.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that because our oldest trees are in these areas in the state. So what kind of species could we expect to see in these kind of historical riparian areas?
Yeah, really quite a broad spectrum, because if you start to break down a riparian area, and especially in Kansas, you know, you think like, oh, okay, riparian area is any area next to water. Well, you think, okay, it's going to be pretty wet there. Well, it's this gradient of well-drained versus not well-drained. Water standing for long durations or water standing for short durations. So really you can run into quite a broad spectrum of species. And trees and shrubs and grasses and forbs, it's generally known that some tolerate water better than others. You know, some just will not survive if they get flooded out and have standing water on them for a long time. And others can tolerate it. And it is a little about the water, but it's really a lot about the oxygen level. You know, anytime an area has got standing water over it, there's less and less oxygen available to those plants as they're covered up. Either they're above ground portions or they're below ground portions. If they're inundated with water, they don't have much oxygen. And so the species you find tend to be those species that can tolerate low levels of oxygen. But then also, and it depends, I guess, for how long can they tolerate those low levels of oxygen. As you kind of move up the gradient, up elevation in those riparian areas, that's where you run into species like black walnut that need water, need good fertile soils, but if they were flooded all the time, they would not survive. compared to a shrub species, as an example, that can tolerate kind of those lower levels of oxygen would be false indigo. And that, or false indigo is one, buttonbush is another one. They grow sometimes right in the, like right on, right in the water's edge. And so they can tolerate those kind of low levels of oxygen. And the interesting thing is species like that, that seems like, oh, they can tolerate water, and really it's kind of just as much about the oxygen. A non-native to Kansas species, but does well here, is bald cypress. And so you'll see that used in urban and community settings because it tolerates low levels of oxygen really well. And whether that is kind of a wet area in a community, like I can picture some city parks across the state that they've got like a stream running through town, and it's been made into a park and because of flooding and stuff. And so bald cypress does really well there. But also some other spots in communities where bald cypress does really well, like on a clay hilltop, because that's low levels of oxygen. And our state office in Manhattan is a prime example of that. It's a hilltop that was, you know, all grass 250 years ago. And as the city of Manhattan grew and developed, and it became a urban and community setting, and the bald cypress were planted at our state office, they're doing fantastic on top of that hill, you know, far away from the bayou in Louisiana, where you'd see, you know, big old bald cypress growing in the swamp.
So what are the jobs of the trees in riparian forests? Why do they matter?
Well, it's kind of like a plant in any landscape context, whether it's wet or dry or hot or cold or high elevation or low elevation. They're just filling a niche, just like any plant. And in Kansas, I kind of mentioned earlier that, you know, those riparian areas are where the trees grew as part of the prairie, not separate from the prairie, but part of the prairie, just because that's what would grow better there, given the conditions. And the conditions were wetter, maybe a little less sunlight, you know, given topography and shading of hills during the day and that kind of thing. But primarily just being wetter and helping to exclude fire. So instead of, you know, a grass species trying to hack out a living in those wetter, fire excluded, a little more nutrient rich environments, you know, that's where trees fill in that gap, being able to tolerate those wetter conditions, being generally less tolerant of fire. But then again, we've got some tree species that are very tolerant of fire, like bur oak, a good prairie tree species. And then fill in the ecological niche and nutrient cycling too, because if nutrient cycling can't happen in soil, that just really messes up the whole soil food web and everything, you know, life that's built upon it. So those trees' jobs in that riparian area is just to keep that whole kind of life cycle within soil, in that whole little micro ecosystem, just keep it going. Whereas other species of plants and types of plants just wouldn't be able to tolerate those types of conditions.
Yeah, so you touched on this already, but how are riparian forests impacting soil health? Are you going in and planting trees as part of a goal to improve soil health for certain landowners?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked that, because that's exactly how I like to sum up my job, beyond just explaining my job title. Yeah, soil health. So, you know, we hear that word a lot, especially in the context of food production, and regenerative ag is another thing. And so all plants, whether it's trees or shrubs or grass, you know, they're helping to contribute a healthy soil. And, you know, the question has to be asked then, well, what is a healthy soil? Because, like, there's the physical and qualities of the physical properties and qualities of soil, but is that also a definition of soil health? So not always. So a good way to think about it is healthy soil is biologically active soil. So I guess I'll take another step back too. on, you know, what is soil? Well, soil is minerals and water and air and then organic matter. So those are the basic ingredients of soil, but they can all vary in kind of ratio. I mean, there's some general ratios that those main ingredients stick with, but it can vary a little bit. And without any of those ingredients, then we don't have soil. And in particular, you know, without the organic matter, then it's just dirt. Or you think of a concrete block, it's minerals. There's a little bit of airspace. There's maybe even a little micro amount of water left in it. So it's got those basic ingredients that soil has, except it doesn't have any organic matter in it. And so, dirt used for constructing the building under, you know, it has minerals, a very small amount of organic matter, hopefully not any organic matter, but a very small amount. And then they compact it to take all the air out of it and drive some moisture out of it. And so then it shifts from soil to just becoming dirt. So soil has to have all those ingredients. And with the organic matter, you know, that's what gives us life. That's where plants can grow and people and animals can eat plants and all of that. So if we know what soil is, including organic matter, and we have to have plants and organisms, all kinds of microorganisms in soil that create that organic matter, and trees help fill that niche and is the plant that can grow in these areas. Those trees, healthy native trees, helps create healthy soil that is a biologically active soil. And there's a whole bunch of details about the symbiotic relationships of plants and microorganisms that live in the soil, funguses and bacteria and protozoa and all kinds of crazy cool stuff about that. But those symbiotic relationships that the plants, the healthy native plants, help create healthy soils. And healthy soil then in turn helps create healthy water. And so that's kind of what my job boils down to, is helping to create a safe and plentiful water supply through using native plants to make healthy soil.
So you had mentioned at one point regenerative agriculture. Would you consider the work that you do to be part of that or in any way related to regenerative agriculture?
Yeah. And I had the pleasure of working in the past with farmers that were really diving into using regenerative ag practices of no-tilling, that is, you know, limiting disturbance of the soil, and cover cropping, and which is trying to keep as many living roots in the ground for as year-round as possible. So I've had the pleasure of working there in the past, and forestry in Kansas is very much agroforestry, because just the nature of our state and the productive agricultural lands we have. And so it has worked really well for me to kind of take the ag background, regenerative ag background a little bit, my whole farm background experience that I grew up with, and apply that to forestry. And my day-to-day job is to help reestablish or establish new woodlands and forest lands in Kansas, an acre or 2 acres or 3 acres at a time, in these riparian areas to help with water quality. So I definitely approach it in a regenerative ag kind of context, because that is proving to work with farmers producing food for us all. And it's proving to work in growing healthy trees in a cost-effective manner. So it's definitely the same, like that in like the everyday how-to, because I'm no-tilling tree seed into standing cover crops and inoculating my cover crop seed with beneficial microorganisms and, you know, practicing all those principles of soil health, some that I mentioned already, like, you know, limiting soil disturbance and having living roots in the ground as long as possible and keeping the soil armored, you know, cover crop residue or plant residue on the ground, continual living roots in the ground. I mentioned plant diversity, you know, all that kind of stuff that's in the regenerative ag world, those kind of those five tenets of soil health in the regenerative ag world, that kind of defines forests also. The fifth one, if you're really familiar with soil health stuff, is livestock. And, you know, in annual cropping systems, whether it's producing, you know, a grain type of crop or a fruit type of crop that we're consuming, integrating livestock into there has advantages for those crops. But then also we have the advantage of livestock and getting some kind of, you know, milk or meat or egg product or whatever from that livestock that we can directly eat. And if livestock in the forest is not quite as clear of a connection, but when you think about livestock's role in regenerative ag and how can we create that habitat for wildlife so that they fill the same role of nutrient cycling is what it boils down to. Having livestock in regenerative ag systems to cycle nutrients and improve soil health. Same in forest lands too, you know, having that diversity of plant types and structure to bring in a diverse selection of wildlife. And it's not just one species, but that diverse selection of wildlife that's going to help with all the nutrient cycling and make a big, happy, healthy ecosystem.
So you've touched on several elements already, but how is it that you do your work? What kind of work are you doing day to day?
Yeah, all right. So the state of Kansas has a big water quality program where they're and quantity program where they're trying to prevent sediment from getting into our surface waters, federal reservoirs, rivers, streams, that kind of thing. And some past studies found that a big source of sediment in surface waters is from eroding stream banks. So the state of Kansas has a program where they're engineering these structural practices to help keep stream banks from eroding further. But they're a combination of structural practices and vegetative practices because a structure has a lifespan. You know, it's just going to age out eventually. And so by incorporating kind of bioengineering principles, it extends the lifespan, you know, if we nail it and get it perfect, it extends it into perpetuity because that vegetation can just keep going year after year. And we don't have to keep hauling excavators out there to, you know, rebuild a project after it ages out. So my everyday job is to manage that revegetation portion of these big stream bank protection projects. And oftentimes it's on cropland or adjacent to cropland. So it's very much like a cropland kind of context. And so after the excavating contractor is done, that's where I move in and approach reforestation, afforestation, that whole revegetation portion of the project, approach that like regenerative ag. So we start with correcting anything, any major structural issues with the soil, like compaction is a killer of all plants, but especially trees, you know, any deep-rooted plant like trees, compaction is really hard on tree growth. So if we have to, we'll try and mitigate that compaction. And then from there, we take more of a biological approach rather than mechanical and chemical approach by cover cropping first. And depending on the site, depending on the soils, depending on the time that we have, sometimes I'll even cover crop it for 2 years. And if it also works to integrate the farmer's row crop production schedule into that, we'll do that to kind of transition that little 70-foot strip along the river there. We'll do that to transition that out of cropland and into eventual forest land. But yeah, we plant a diverse mix of cover crop species. Sometimes it's a cool season mix like cereal rye and turnips and radishes. Other times it's a warm season mix like millet and sorghum sedan grass and cowpeas and mung beans. And just depends on the time of year and the soils and everything. So a lot of cover cropping. And then when the site is right, then we'll take off from there on actually establishing the trees and the shrubs. And Historically, we've done that with seedlings by transplanting seedlings, whether they were grown in an outdoor nursery or in a greenhouse, transplanting a couple hundred trees per acre, you know, somewhere between 400 to 800 trees per acre. And but the shift we've taken now is, again, kind of getting back to a soil health approach, is direct seeding of trees and shrubs. So this has been a lot of fun to work on, because there's been some challenges in the past that have limited the success of direct seeding trees and shrubs. So what I mean is, like, taking the acorn, taking the walnut, taking the teeny tiny little sycamore seed, maple seeds, they're pretty small. They're like half the size of a pea. So planting those seeds directly in the ground, right where we want a tree to grow. And not necessarily right where we want a tree to grow, because I very, very much approach my work as managing the whole entire stand of trees, not individual trees. And so we put a lot of seed out there. And I like to joke that I plant trees just like planting corn, 30,000 seeds per acre on 30-inch rows, and I'm even using a modified corn planter. And it works really well, though, because that modified corn planter gives us precision placement of seed. We can no-till into that standing cover crop and, really control our population. I can mix a diverse selection of species of seed a lot easier than I can mix a diverse selection of seedlings. And it's a lot of fun the way I do that, actually. A little side story is, I used to take, you know, hundreds of pounds of acorns and walnuts and pecans and hickories and whatever, and just mix them in a big tub, or a livestock water tank, actually, is what I would do. You know, dump in 20 pounds of this, 50 pounds of that, whatever, and mix it all up with a shovel. And it took a long time to mix up several thousand pounds that way. And I had kind of a friend, a colleague that worked at the co-op, and I knew how they mix cover crop seed and blend different fertilizers. And so I asked him and if he could help me out, and he said sure. So I brought about 4,000 pounds of acorns, walnuts, pecans, hickories, brought them there, we ran them into their seed mixer. And it was great, because farmers were coming through, you know, buying fertilizer and doing whatever business they do at the co-op, and they could obviously tell something was different seeing a Forest Service truck there. And they could see that our pro boxes, and a pro box, if you don't know, it's a big black box about the size of a pallet and about 5 feet tall. And it's what corn and soybean seed is often kind of transported around with. And so anyway, these farmers pulling in and seeing pro boxes not full of corn or beans, but full of acorns, and they pull up and say, "What in the world is going on here?" And so anyway, it's a lot of fun. But yeah, we you know, run in 4,000 pounds of acorns and walnuts and pecans, big hardwood tree seed, into the mixer and mix it all up in about 4 minutes and run it back out. And now I have this diverse selection of tree species to plant with that modified corn planter. And so we get a wide variety of plant diversity out there, tree diversity. And the reason why that's important is because, just like in the regenerative ag world and soil health world, that they know for sure that cover crop blends of seed perform better, like multiple species blended together perform better than single species. And that's because of the kind of the ecological collaboration that plants do and how they interact with all the soil organisms and microorganisms. And so what's cool about this, and it's the same in trees, you know, there's been stands of trees that have been direct seeded a long time ago, and compared to or single species stands of trees direct seeded a long time ago compared to the multi-species stands of trees that were direct seeded. And just like in cover cropping, the multi-species performs better because the difference in root architecture, you know, just root shapes and sizes, some go deeper, some stay shallower, some are big, some are small. And then So aside from the physical properties, then you get into associations that tree roots and all kinds of plant roots form with the microorganisms, and they all just kind of work together better than working separately. And they'll share resources. They'll do that through the soil fungus network called mycorrhizae. And this sounds like science fiction kind of stuff, just sounds crazy. But if one tree is struggling, the stand of trees will kind of determine, like, okay, yeah, we'll help you out. We'll lift you up. We'll ship some extra nutrients or whatever that way. Or it may go the other way. If a tree is struggling, they may cut it off and then it gets suppressed. And I know it just sounds wild and crazy and completely unbelievable, but research has been done, and so that the academic world can prove it. But it's kind of more fun to hear and see the real life stories and hear the anecdotal evidence of it. And that's what I've been able to witness through some colleagues that have been direct seeding longer than I have. And but we see those same kind of results, you know, just the good strong root system growing in place, and you know, getting those healthy living roots in the ground and keeping them in the ground as long as possible. And our trees are performing quite well and tolerating the harsh, dry second half of summers that we get, compared to seedlings with a less vigorous root system that we have to baby and take care of a little more to get them to survive.
That's awesome. And I'm so glad that you lean into like some of the really cool ecology stuff and the soil, because it's so interesting. And there are some great books out there if anybody listening wants to learn more, because that soil science, especially with trees, is just really cool.
It is. It's wild. And I have a ton more to learn myself and have had a great time learning about just kind of the very basics of it, getting exposed from some of the great research that's going on in this state, at K-State, at the University of Kansas, at Fort Hays State, Emporia, all over. I should name them all, really. But some awesome work going on in this state and in ecology and in the context of regenerative ag and that kind of thing. So I've got a lot more to learn, and it's just a wild, wild world out there in soil ecology.
So for any landowners listening that may have a riparian project that they want to work on, what are those initial first steps? Should they reach out to you? Are there other agencies that they need to work with? What should they do to start that process?
Yeah, good question. If you've got a spot in, next to the stream or next to a wetland that you have that you just, you know, want to try and make a little better, whatever better is for you, yeah, get in touch with us. We've got rural district foresters stationed all throughout the state that are a great first contact, and their contact information can be found on our website, or if you know your county extension agent, they can probably get you pointed in that direction, or your county conservation district manager can get you pointed in that direction. And all of those folks too are also another great start. Or if you've worked with Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks, the private lands wildlife biologists, they're a great first start also. And so if it comes to specific tree and shrub questions, yeah, we can definitely help out with that. Whether it's the district forester, or maybe the district forester will send that request on to me and we'll collaborate on it. Because in theory, I have statewide responsibilities where the district forester is going to be working just in your kind of specific geographic area. And we'll do what we can to shift that, you know, species of, or the species composition of trees and shrubs into something that might be a little more ecologically fitting. Or if you have, say you want to explore some other benefits like timber harvest or food harvest, like a food forest kind of thing, and get the right species in there for that, we can definitely help out with that. So yeah, then some of those folks that I mentioned for initial contact, and then from there just start thinking big, because it takes time. So start thinking big in terms of timeline. The planning process can take a little time, but really the implementation time is where it really takes time, especially if there's like an invasive species that needs to be controlled ahead of time. that might take a couple years to get that under control. And then, you know, the planting and establishment time and all that, the site prep time. So, you know, think big, but don't let the timeline scare you away, because results can happen pretty quick. And, you know, after 10 years and you look back and think where you started and where you're at, it can be pretty eye-opening. And then, of course, there's always the future generations that'll benefit from your work. So yeah, make those initial contacts and allow for enough time on your side, and we'll go from there.
And I will make sure to link information for how to get in touch with your rural foresters in the show notes, because, like Andy said, that's a great place to start. Kind of wrapping up here today, as you think about all the landowners that you've worked with and the projects you've worked on, what do you feel like is the biggest concern that Kansas landowners have today in these riparian forests?
Oh boy, that's a good question. In the eastern part of the state, bush honeysuckle is a big concern moving in. And so that plant is a non-native, and it's kind of got an upper edge on native plants because it leafs out really early in the spring. And so it just starts growing a lot sooner, and then it retains its leaves later in the fall. So it just has that advantage. And the little berries are like Pop-Tarts for birds. So it's delicious, not really nutritionally very good for them, but they love them. So the seeds are spread pretty easily. So anyway, it's just a tough issue. I think bush honeysuckle is a big one. Whether it's a riparian forest being newly established or an existing one that's, you know, in great shape. So invasive species are a challenge. But then other challenges is that long-term management, I think. You know, planting is kind of the fast and easy part, but long-term weed control, or maybe some fire needs to be introduced in that landscape. And how do you get prescribed fire on the ground in a safe and productive manner? You know, that's a huge challenge. So just some of those resource management tasks that are maybe a little overwhelming to tackle because it takes a lot of time, or a really expensive piece of equipment, or you know, just some limiting factor on that resource management. And so that's where I'll put a plug in, though, for our contractors across the state that do some of that work. If you're a little worried about it might be a project that's a little more than what you can bite off, we've got a list on our website of contractors that can, of course, you know, fee for service, but can help you accomplish those tasks. And during the planning process too, with us or KDWP or anybody else, we can explore some financial assistance programs that can help lessen the initial cost of some of those management activities.
I'm so glad you mentioned the contractors, because they really are essential. Most people wouldn't be able to achieve the work that needs to be done without them.
Yeah, for sure. On my little lot where I live on, and, you know, the tree work and the Johnson grass control work and the erosion work I had to do early on, like, very time consuming and overwhelming for me. And that's my full-time professional job. Yeah. And I can't make it happen on my own place. You know, a classic example of Shoemaker's son goes barefoot. And so if you've got a lot of space, you know, several acres, that can be really overwhelming. And our contractors are just a great resource to help out with that.
Well, as we wrap up today, one question I like to ask people on the podcast is if you have either a favorite tree species or like a specific tree that you love, like an individual that in a park or on your property that you like to visit.
Oh, yeah. Well, there is, I can kind of answer that with one tree, bur oak. I love bur oak because, you know, they grow to become these big, stately, majestic trees, and the kind of conditions they'll tolerate, and you know, they're a prairie tree. They can tolerate fire with that big, thick, gnarly bark they have. The acorns they produce, of course, helping to feed wildlife that I enjoy. And so bur oak is like one of my favorite tree species. And then specifically, there's this big bur oak along the Delaware River that is the backdrop on my phone screensaver, actually. And it's just an amazing tree because I don't know how old it is, hundreds of years old. And it's this huge tree, and there's no other big remaining trees around it, which is a little bit of a bummer. And it's probably because something I recently learned about is when land was being cleared to farm for food production, and they were using manpower and mules and oxen and horses, they would need a tree to anchor into with their ropes or chains and pulleys. And so this tree along the Delaware River was probably one of those anchor trees that they used to hook a block and tackle to and hook the team to pull stumps of the other surrounding bur oak and black walnut and hickory that was probably cleared out of there. So it's a pretty cool old tree. Also some really cool big old bur oaks in Council Grove. Of course, that's, you know, the namesake of that town. All the early American history and the councils they had in those groves of trees. So a lot of big, cool ones there. And then sycamore is another one, too. And maybe not specific sycamores, but I just think sycamore is such a cool tree because it stands out in the landscape, especially in the winter. It's kind of white, gray bark kind of standing out against the rest of the darker trees out there. And great wildlife tree, of course, and a riparian tree, likes water, uses a lot of water. So kind of a cool tree. And I can imagine, or I'm remembering some certain sycamores along different rivers and creeks that I've seen that are just these big old gnarly trees. And you think how many cranes have roosted up in those sycamores and stuff like that. And it's just kind of fun to think about all that.
Yeah, that's super cool. And I had no idea about using that anchor tree. That's really, really neat.
Yeah, pretty cool. Pretty wild how they did it. They just couldn't get that last dump because they didn't have big excavators and dozers back then. They did it by hand.
Yeah, that would be a lot.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Andy, so much for being on today. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Oh, it's been fun being here today, Ariel. Thanks so much for having me. I love talking about this kind of regenerative ag approach to establishing trees and shrubs. We didn't even get into talking about how it could be used for upland establishment for, say, like a quail covey headquarters of American Plum or something. But, boy, there's so much more I could talk about. So I really appreciate you having me on today. And if anybody has any questions, my contact info can be found on our website, and I would love to help you out in any way with any of your projects, whether they're next to a stream or a wetland or not. And get outside. Go enjoy all this awesome landscape that we live in here in Kansas.
That's fantastic. And I will make sure to include Andy's contact information in the show notes. And you kind of touched on it, but there's so many different things you could talk about. So if anybody's listening to this and they think, oh, Andy mentioned that, I want to hear more, let me know and we'll have Andy back on the podcast. That's how
great.
You solve that. Thank you all so much for listening today. Again, this is the Kansas Canopy Podcast. This has been season 4, episode 2, and we hope